Coming up this week in computer hardware, new iPhone 11 Pro, iPhone 11 and Apple Watch 5, AMD Ryzen 3000 firmware update, Apple Arcade, XFX Radeon 5700. It's thick. All that and more coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 533, recorded on September 12th, 2019. The iPhone goes pro. This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by Mint Mobile. They provide the same premium network coverage you're used to, but at a fraction of the cost because everything is online. Mint Mobile makes it easy to cut your wireless bill down to just $15 a month with their three-month introductory plan and get the plan shipped to your door free at mintmobile.com/twitch. Welcome to Twitch This Week in Computer Hardware, Twitch weekly show that aims to bring you. Well, this week we're going to be talking a whole lot about announcements from Apple, a little bit about AMD, some exciting new GPUs, and mayhem. I'm Patrick Norton, joined by Mr. Sebastian Peek of PCPer.com. Sebastian, are you excited to be alive on Apple Phone 11 week?
Is that what this is? Okay. I was busy with PC hardware. Sorry, Patrick. I didn't really watch the events, but
wow. I should say iPhone 11. Well, this is interesting, right? IP68 water resistance, 4 meters to 30 minutes should you like the deep end of the pool. Stainless steel banding, and of course, glass backs, because everyone thinks glass backs are more durable. A fantastic new green color. We have the iPhone 11. Well, that's the iPhone 11, but I'm talking about the iPhone 11 Pro right now and the Pro Max. They're claiming 4 more hours of battery life than the iPhone XS, 5 more than the XS Max, an OLED HDR Super Retina XDR display, up to a staggering 1,200 nits, which is if you know, if you're paying thousands of dollars for instrumentation to use on the deck of a boat, that's what we're talking about in the 1,000-1,200 nit range. That's really bright. The A13 Bionic chips, Apple claims 20% faster CPU and GPU than the A12 or up to. They're also claiming it consumes 40% less power. This is interesting. So an HDR OLED, and again, up to 1,200 nits brightness. If you're watching the video, if we could scroll back up to the top. I want everybody to take a real close look at those cameras. There are three of them. It is a bump, and Apple doesn't give a good gosh darn what you think about it. That was the first thing I saw, and this was like, wow, look at that bump. A wide, an ultra-wide, and a telephoto lens. Phil Schiller, Senior Vice President of Worldwide Marketing at Apple, says the iPhone 11 Pro and 11 Pro Max are the most powerful and advanced smartphones we have ever made. They are packed with sophisticated technology that pros can count on to get their work done, and for anyone who wants the very best device made, even if they are not a pro. The comments on this were particularly venomous, even for an Apple enthusiast site. Like we're talking about over at Mac Rumors. For example, who really uses a phone professionally? And actually, if you're talking about the world of YouTubers and Instagrammers and various other organizations, quite a few, although quite a few that you might think are using phones are actually using professional photographers with incredibly expensive rigs. This is Apple's first triple camera system. And of course, as Apple always says, the best camera we have ever made. It provides our customers with a great range of creative control and advanced photo and video editing features in iOS 13. I love that. If you're watching the video, you can see the spinner, Super Retina XDR. They're basically saying, of course, the brightest, most advanced display in iPhone. Spatial audio on board, gigabit class, LTE, up to 1.6 gigabits per second. Wi-Fi 6, which actually I think is one of the most useful additions to the phone. Dual SIM with eSIM. My understanding is they're going to have 6 gigabytes of RAM in the Pro. Pre-orders start Friday the 13th at 4 a.m. And the 64-gigabyte version will be $1,000 for the Pro, $1,100 for the Pro Max. And they jumped to 256 and 512-gigabyte versions. I'll give you a hint. You probably want the 256 gigabyte version at a minimum. Apple Watch Series 5. It's pretty. You can see, if you're watching the video right now, you're seeing the sort of build video that they put together for that. I think self-defense, I was afraid to see what the maxed out Pro pricing was. But if you, look at that. It's like watching the Merble factor testing in the IKEA store. So just for fun, we're going to look at the iPhone 11 Pro Max. Let's just see how expensive this gets in midnight green, which is like British racing green, but without the pedigree. So this iPhone Pro Max, 64 gigabytes, $1,100. 256 gigabytes, $1,249. 512 gigabytes, $1,449. Man, $156 for an extra 190-something gigabytes of memory. It's math is hard. another 192 megabytes of memory. Not in love with the prices, but definitely looking at the 256 gigabyte version as the sweet spot. And then for the iPhone 11 Pro, you're looking at $1,149 or $1,349. So not super cheap either way, but these are flagship numbers. Are you excited? Do you care? Are you all about the low light videography possible with the magnificent iPhone 11 Pro? You professional, you, Sebastian.
It's intriguing. I mean, that was one of the big focuses of the event from the recaps I've read. Basically, that video was a priority here. They're not claiming to have the best smartphone camera. They're claiming to have the best smartphone video camera. And I think a lot of that. Yeah. I mean, what I really am intrigued by is these claims they've made about battery life while at the same time improving performance. And we see stuff like that when companies shrink the process node down from, say, like 14 or 12 or 10 nanometers down to 7 nanometers. Now, are we seeing significant reductions in power draw under load, or is this just far more aggressive and intelligent use of like idle states, like going into really, really low power modes or turning off cores completely, like gating off cores when the phone does not need to use them? So,
I mean, it's we're talking like GPU level transistor counts, 8.5 billion transistors. They're not really telling you much about. They're basically not telling you anything other than kind of, gee-whizzy stuff. Like two performance cores, 20% faster, 30% lower power. Four efficiency cores, 20% faster, 40% lower power. GPU metal-optimized, four core, 20% faster. They're just saying like faster, lower power, faster, lower power. They have machine learning they're claiming built into it, an eight-core neural engine. But it had 6x faster matrix multiplication, should you be into matrix multiplication. I'm kind of curious. Maybe the efficiency cores are powerful enough to do more work than in the past. There's a lot of... We haven't seen any benchmarks. Nobody's tested it yet. We don't have any real life numbers. Not a lot of information on this.
That's standard for them, though.
Yeah, I mean it's a classic moment. iPhone 11 also announced dual cameras, ultra wide and wide dual cameras. Six new pastelish colors. There's kind of a rainbow of them that they put together for the websites. There they are. That's the picture from the Apple website on Mac Rumors. I have not looked up the name of those because I'll start giggling hysterically. Dolby Atmos sound, A13 Bionic chip, also IP68, but only 2 meters for 30 minutes. Also has the night mode and the cameras and gigabit LTE dual SIM with eSIM. This is kind of a classic Apple moment. We've come up with a better camera or a better phone and a better, better phone. You know, the iPhone 8 still in the range, iPhone XR, iPhone 11, iPhone Pro. The iPhone Pro is, it's kind of, you know, it's going to be shipping on 920. Pricing on this one's, you know, less, considerably less. You're talking about 64 gigabyte version for $700, 128 gigs for $749, 256 gigabytes for $849. White, black, green, yellow, purple. Very basic names, which is kind of a plus. Unlocked, basically same price as the regular ones. Kind of the stuff we expect, which I'm kind of down with. The iPhone 11, 6.1-inch liquid retina HD display. Glass and aluminum. It's interesting, right? Because with the Pros, they went to stainless steel instead of aluminum, which I am actually a big fan of. Everybody's got Face ID. Everybody's got 813. They're claiming 1 hour better battery life than the iPhone 11. Or the iPhone 11, they're claiming 1 hour battery life than the XR. Liquid Retina HD display, so not the Super Retina XDR display.
It's crazy. It's all just more and better, but not... You know, no actual hard numbers yet, of course.
What's kind of crazy, right? That the iPhone 11 Pro and the iPhone 11 Pro Max, you're looking at 458 pixels per inch, which is, you know, the fact that the pixel count is that high and they're claiming better battery life is really interesting.
The relationship between the 1200 nit brightness and the battery life is interesting to me. So I'm wondering what the actual brightness level of.
Well, it's interesting, right? Because when you start. When you start digging into the specs for the phones, and let me see if I can drop those into the rundown. When you start digging down into the specs on the phone, right, they're looking at 800 nits max brightness typical versus the 1200 nits that they blew all over the presentation. And then for iPhone 11, they're talking about 625 nits max brightness, which is nothing to sneeze at. You know, all these phones are under 8 ounces, under 7 ounces. For the 11 Pro and the 11. Pretty impressive. I mean, you know, the specs are actually pretty equal between the 11 and the Pro Max on a lot of stuff. Which makes me wonder how much that third camera cost them and the processing. Everything's got Wi-Fi 6. Everything's got Bluetooth 5.0, ultra wideband.
But Patrick, does it have 5G? Does it have 5G?
No, and as much as I'd like to ding them for that, you know, 5G barely exists at this point. And by the time it exists, you'll probably want whatever the newest radios are that are available at that point. Chris Welch did a nice article up on The Verge. And the title's kind of funny, right? Apple's iPhone 11 doesn't have 5G because 5G isn't ready for the iPhone. But he points out, you know, because it's The Verge, they've gotten a lot of hands-on time, and they're in New York, right? You know, AT&T, basically, if you're not a professional customer or developer, you don't have access to their 5G network. Millimeter wave 5G, which is where the really staggering speeds are coming, has incredibly short distances. He says he's tested Verizon's 5G in Chicago twice and T-Mobile's millimeter wave network in New York City. With both carriers, 5G has blown me away with hard-to-believe speed, but coverage often exists on a block-by-block basis and is extremely sensitive to anything that comes between you and the millimeter wave node to make those instant downloads possible. For example, buildings, people, Sprinter vans, taxi cabs. Indoor coverage doesn't exist for the millimeter wave stuff. He says Sprint's not so bad because it's mid-band spectrum, not millimeter wave. There's not much 5G in the U.S. at this point. So I think it's reasonable for them not to, you know, if you buy into the idea that Apple does a lot of things when it will provide something that makes Apple look better than the competition or be of actual benefit to their customer base. I can see why they didn't do 5G. Oh my goodness. Apple Watch Series 5 also came out. the always-on Retina display, an optional titanium case, built-in compass, a better maps app, a Watch OS 6. Series 5 with GPS is going to start at $399. Cellular models start at $499. So many pretty bands. You can order those now. They're going to be shipping on the 20th, basically a week from now. Series 4 is going to go away. The Series 3 is going to be the entry level, $199 for GPS, $299 for GPS cellular. I will say something that probably excited me more than anything else is AppleCare Plus monthly plans are now going to switch to a subscription model, and there's no longer going to be a two-year cap on repairs. You can basically pay monthly till it's canceled. That's not just for the watches. You know, your plan basically renews monthly until you get into the cancellation. Either you cancel it or Apple decides, quote, is no longer able to service your covered equipment due to the unavailability of service parts, in which case Apple will provide you with 30 days prior written notice of cancellation or whatever else is required by law. So basically, you know, if you had a new Apple phone, you would probably be paying AppleCare Plus, you'd be paying $7.99 a month. You know, so or $399 a month for the Apple Watch Series 5, like $8 a month for the iPhone XR. So
definitely seems like a nod to the fact that people are keeping their devices longer.
Yeah. Because
for the longest time, iPhone users were the ones who upgraded every single year. That's when they created that iPhone upgrade program. They had their own in-store financing for things. Kind of around the time that all the carriers just started doing like the $20 and $30 a month phone upgrades anyway. Early upgrades.
It could also be tied in.
Thing. Yeah.
I could say it also can be tied into the sort of larger conversation about the availability of repair parts, the ability to repair these devices, and, you know, that sort of long conversation we got into about security and being able to update batteries and using legitimate parts. You know, one of the challenges was, you know, you could basically max out your Apple warranty at 2 years, and then you would pay what was an outrageous fee. So maybe they're trying to make everything more, you know, approachable, if you will. I think it's good that they're offering an extended warranty. You know, I also, you know, through careful selection of cases and the use of tempered glass screen protectors, have managed to not blow out any screens, knock on wood, in quite some time. But I also got to say, I wish they went to, you know, thicker, more badass stainless steel and everything, because aluminum is just easy to bend on a phone if you're me. Of course, a month after I get the boys' new entry-level iPads, they come out with a new 10.2-inch iPad. You know, I would be upset, except that the iPads that the boys got to replace their old iPads or old iPads or Series 1 iPad. So, you know, I think we got 8 years out of those, so that's pretty good. It's also interesting because I was like, wow, major stylistic changes on the website with those goofy fonts on the Apple.com website. Kind of the big change for this, with this iPad in the lineup, all of the iPads are compatible with the Smart Keyboard, which I think is an interesting choice. You know, it's an iPad. It's faster. You know, it's compatible with the pen. It's compatible with the super awesome, oh boy, keyboard, which is a little painful. I also say, you know, $99 for that pen is kind of brutal. You know, this is also going to be a fairly powerful iPad for the money. 32 gigabyte, 128 gigabyte versions. I love the fact that it's got a slightly larger screen, and you know, $429 for the 128 gigabyte version, which is, I think, probably for anybody who wants to carry a lot of content, a good idea to upgrade from the 32 gigabyte version at $329. You know, other than that, it's pretty much a standard, uses a Lightning, which kind of, I wish they'd gone to USB-C on this one, but they're still using a Lightning cable on that one.
I wonder when they're going to finally make the leap.
Yeah, A10 Fusion chip. 8-megapixel camera. So, you know, 1080p recording, slow-mo video at 720p. Not a lot of huge changes on this. Kind of a good, solid entry-level iPad that now offers support for that super pricey, well, to me, I think it's super pricey pencil
and keyboard.
I was surprised by the $329 starting price. That's good. I mean, if Apple wants to start selling things for less money, that's good for everybody. But $329 makes that more doable for kids, especially.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny. Best Buy was running a pretty fat discount on the 128 gigabyte versions. That was not, you know, I want to say it was under $400. And obviously now we know that they were running out of the inventory, running through the inventory before the launch of the new iPad. What else is going on? All iPhone 11 models have the U1 ultra wideband chip for spatial awareness, whose underlying tech would enable Apple's rumored tile-like tracking tags. Engadget went kind of berserk on that subject. The actual title of the article, iPhone 11's ultra-wideband chip helps you airdrop with the right person. The UN also hints at possible support for tracking tags. John Fingus wrote that up for Engadget. So there were no actual mentions of tracking tags anywhere in the presentation. But, the U1 is supposed to offer some highly precise location finding, to quote Mr. Fingus. And in September 30th, you can point your U1-equipped iPhone at another person with a U1-equipped iPhone, and AirDrop will allow them to share his files faster. Should you find yourself sharing files with people carrying iPhones and both of you have the latest iPhone, we'll see. That's kind of the whole article is kind of a giant speculation on what could they do with the ultra-wideband chip? Will it be glorious? Will it replace your tile? Will it do your windows? We don't know, but we're very excited. So, Rise community updates, BIOS updates for Boost and Idle, which are not as here as you might think based on that super excited title.
Yes.
What's going on?
Robert Halleck over at AMD has been keeping the community updated. Basically, this is, I think, the sixth major update post in the series since the launch of the Ryzen processors. And if you've been following mainstream tech news over the last week, you've probably heard about this. And a couple of outlets like Tom's Hardware already did some preliminary testing with this new, one of the new BIOS updates that leaked out online. But we have to temper our enthusiasm here a little bit. Basically, what AMD did was they said that they were coming out with a fix for, we talked about this last week, for the boost, what's the word? Not regression, but just the fact that a lot of the Ryzen processors, according to users, as reported by YouTuber Der Bauer, were not meeting their actual boost targets, like the advertised boost speeds of the processors. I think around 2,700 people of those surveyed were not, could be wrong on those numbers, but the vast majority of people with Ryzen processors in the new 3000 series were not seeing the boost clocks that AMD had advertised that had been in every presentation that was on the box. So they changed their verbiage to say, well, that's like a max boost under certain circumstances. But what really happened was the firmware changed from the pre-launch to post-launch period. And AMD uses this sort of combination firmware update that they call, well, it's the AGESA code, AGESA. Right. And they were on version 1002 when they first seeded the processors to reviewers. I did all my testing on 1002. Technically, it's 1.0.0.2, but that's, you know, it's going to get harder to say as they keep on adding letters to this, because they went from 1002 to 1003, but then they just started adding letters to it. So this latest update, which they had teased a week ago or so, it's sort of been formally announced, but it's not available. It's going to be rolling out over the next 3 weeks from motherboard vendors who actually have to provide you with the BIOS updates for the particular board that you have. So they have to internally validate it. They have to, you know, make sure it works with all the memory that's on their qualified vendor list and all that good stuff that they have to do. But we're up to version 1003 ABBA. They have added a fourth letter. It is now ABBA, and it's just getting kind of ridiculous at this point with the letters. But they have, what they have addressed here is the way that it boosts, and pretty much all we're going to be getting are these blog updates from the AMD community, because they don't publish any kind of a white paper on this. They don't publish a release note on any of these AGESA update changes. So we just have to kind of parse through this rather long article and try to figure out exactly what they're doing. One thing they did specifically call out as far as voltage goes, they say it's not capped. They say, please keep in mind, this firmware change is not a cap. I had noted with the Ryzen 5 3600X review, that was the first time I visited a AGESA 1003AB, that there was pretty much a hard cap on that processor at 1.44 volts when previously it had been easily boosting up to like 1.485 and even close to 1.5. And those are small differences, but it makes a big difference when you're actually talking about sustained boost frequencies and how fast the CPU is allowed to run. And it's voltage limited at that point. It could boost higher, but it was pretty much capped. They're saying that this new update does not contain a cap. So I would expect single-threaded boost numbers to be a little bit higher once we see some shipping BIOS revisions out there. They also addressed idle voltages, which they say you'll expect to see around 1.2 volts at idle, which is lower than it has been. That's good. I mean, if there were any concerns about longevity with these chips, which Intel absolutely has indicated, at least if you infer that from the slides they had at IFA 2019, they were quoting different outlets. One of my charts actually ended up on the list where we were showing before and after, like 1002 versus 1003. And Der Bauer was on the list. And he wasn't very happy about it, but, you know. They went out there and looked at the reviews that were out there and showed, oh, hey, look, here's a drop of like 10% from one AGESA code version to the next. And that's significant. It depends on the workload. Yes. It depended on the benchmark. But that's why AMD came out and said, hey, we're going to address this. So in a way, it's really good that Der Bauer made such a big deal out of this, because he has enough followers, enough clout, that it seemingly, because of his report, AMD came out and said, hey, we're going to look into this. And now Robert Halleck from AMD has made this community update. And you can read it in great detail. One of the other things that was mentioned, besides the changes to boost, the new what they call calmer idle, where the lower voltage idle for the CPUs, also they have a new monitoring SDK. So there were 30 plus API calls made available just in this first version, which is, it's coming. They've already incorporated a couple of things into AMD's Ryzen Master software, which you can download, which has average core voltage enabled. There's other stuff coming, just better and more effective monitoring of your CPU's voltage, current operating temperature, peak speed, effective frequency, which they say is, they're kind of factoring time spent in sleep states. So just far more granular reporting is going to be possible. So some of those monitoring apps that everybody uses, like HW Info and HDMon, you know, they're going to be able to tap into these APIs and have a far more accurate look at what's actually going on with the CPU. This is something that AMD has never been quite as good at least with the monitoring tools that are out there.
Right.
Especially with the last generation, we were still dealing with temperature offsets with Ryzen 2000 processors, where the actual reported temperature might be like up to 20 degrees different than the actual internal temperature. So it's only a good thing if we have more access to what's actually going on with these CPUs. So again, all of this, while sort of formalized with this community update, there are no actual shipping BIOS updates for any of the motherboards supporting Ryzen 3000 yet. You can absolutely Google this. You can go find the version that Tom's Hardware used, the version that I think WCCF Tech used. There are some leaked beta BIOS versions from like MSI and some other vendors out there, but nothing that these vendors are willing to actually ship yet.
We wait with bated breath. And we'll probably be waiting for a while. I'm curious. We'll see. 3 weeks. 3 weeks from 2 days ago. So 1, 2, 3, we're looking at October 1st. We'll see if they actually show up on October 1st. That'll be interesting. You know what else is interesting? Saving money. I like saving money. This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware brought to you by Mint Mobile. If you're still using one of the big wireless providers in 2019, you know, the ones that make you use, you know, I was looking at the, I don't understand why people don't always buy unlocked phones. I was looking at those Apple phones we were talking about earlier in the show. Just, I hate buying phones that aren't unlocked, right? You ever wonder what you're paying for when you're looking at one of the big carriers? Expensive retail stores, inflated prices, hidden fees, you know, they just know you're going to pay. So why you should be thinking about Mint Mobile. Mint Mobile provides the same premium network coverage you're used to, but at a fraction of the cost because everything is online. No brick and mortar, no crazy expensive retail spaces. Mint Mobile saves on retail locations. They save on overhead. Then they pass those savings right on to you. Really, this is the way wireless should be done. Easy, online, phone coverage, right? Mint Mobile makes it easy to cut your wireless bill down to just $15 a month with their 3-month introductory plan. Get unlimited nationwide talk and text. You can stop paying for unlimited data you don't use, right? You got 3, 8, 12 gigabyte plans and 4G LTE data. You can use your own phone with any Mint Mobile plan. Keep your same phone number, all your existing contacts, great service. Do yourself a favor, ditch your old wireless bill and start saving with Mint Mobile. To get your new wireless plan for just $15 a month with their 3-month introductory plan and to get the plan shipped to your door for free, go to mintmobile.com/twitch. That's mintmobile.com/TWICH. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month with their 3-month introductory plan. That's mintmobile.com/twitch. And we want to thank Mint Mobile for their support of This Week in Computer Hardware. I like saving money. It makes me happy. I also kind of like G-Sync. And LG OLED TVs are getting NVIDIA G-Sync. If you are gaming in the living room or you want to game with a big monitor, right? We talked about Dell... Alienware, we should say, actually. Dell's Alienware delivering big, giant gaming monitors a few weeks ago. And so NVIDIA G-Sync HDR BFG displays, you know, we thought they were coming. You know, and it's the article that you linked, like PC World's Brad Chakos was writing about this. Like basically the only one we've actually seen is HP's $5,000 Omen 10 Imperium. Now going to think of it as being the unfortunately named.
And I was going to say, if you thought LG's OLEDs were expensive, and for a 55-inch, I think they're around $2,000 most of the time.
For an OLED, but, yeah. Sure.
$5,000.
And for granted, a 65-inch television.
Yeah. And that has the G-Sync hardware in it. When I first saw this, I'm like, how are they enabling this? Is there just like an FPGA or something? No, it's software. Or really what it is they've validated it for use with like NVIDIA's G-Sync compatible program. So it has to meet certain criteria. This is not... You know, magically they've enabled this chip on the board that's been dormant, but with this firmware update, it unlocks the full potential of G-Sync. It's not a G-Sync monitor with its own dedicated chip. So they're not, it's right. Not, the T-Con is not changing. It's just, well, now it's compatible. So they have a very strict, I mean, very, very few monitors make it through their certification process, mostly because of, it's like a 2.4:1 refresh ratio they want. They want you to be able to go down quite a bit from 60 hertz to actually meet their requirements. But it's interesting that these TVs are going to be capable of doing that.
I don't know. That HP, I'm curious who's actually buying these because it's a 65-inch television. It's $5,000. I mean, 144 hertz refresh rates. It's got an NVIDIA Shield built in. That's just a lot of money for a 65-inch television. Display HDR 1000, VESA certified, which is cool. 384 zones of direct array backlight, which is nice, right? It means the color should be really, really impressive. But goodness, that's an expensive television. It's a lot of money for a 65-inch TV.
The question's going to be, if you're a gamer, say you actually have $5,000, would you buy this HP Omen with, I mean, 384 zone backlight is not that outstanding for a 65-inch display. It's okay.
Right.
It'll certainly get rid of like the glow around black bars if you're watching a wide format movie. But I mean, compare that to OLED, there's no comparison, except for the fact that this is 144 hertz and these LG OLEDs are not overdriving them. They're still going to be 60 hertz when you're using them as a PC monitor. So, I mean, it's going to be a wider refresh. It's going to be compatible with lower frame rates. So if you are gaming at 4K on a single graphics card, which even like an RTX 2080, you're not going to be getting 60 frames per second at 4K Ultra in your favorite games. So it's probably a good thing that it can sync up with whatever your GPU is actually putting out. But again, only up to 60 hertz, which I know that sounds bad when you're comparing it to 144 hertz monitor. Remember, this is 4K and it takes tweaking and massaging the settings to get native 4K at 144 frames per second. So do you want to play?
Not really sure I'm feeling this.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're watching that slider on the video right now, it's super impressive. It's brighter.
It is.
I don't know. It's interesting because one of the things we run into this year is so many of the improvements we're seeing on gaming displays seem to mostly involve stuff that's going to be enormously difficult to notice while you are gaming your face off, trying not to get fragged. I have feels. Mostly I feels that I'm not ready to pay that much money for a television like this. But it's nice that it's actually coming out. XFX Radeon RX 57 XT thick to review.
Yes.
What's the word?
Well, first I had to take a double take. I think it was videocards.com who, of course, if you follow this industry, they're always the ones who have the inside. However it is that they get their information, they're usually early and pretty accurate. And they had this XFX thick, and that's THICC for those of you like me who have no idea how to interpret modern lingo. But yeah, this is indeed thick. From the standpoint that it is, it's a lot more of a cooler than you're going to be getting with the reference card. Actually, this is really cool. If you're watching the video, the back of it is probably the most interesting aspect of the design, if I can actually find a good angle here. It looks kind of like the grill of a 1950s car. But this is a 2.5 slot cooler design. It's wider, taller, in every dimension, bigger than a reference card. Actually sticks out, like it's about an inch taller than the expansion slot on the back. So you need some space for this card to breathe. And
right.
Besides the aesthetics of the card, which are very nice, it's kind of understated. There's no RGBs on it at all if you don't like RGBs. But what it comes down to is the cooling capabilities of the reference AMD Radeon RX 5700 XT are pretty notorious at this point, because AMD even had to come out and say 110 degrees is fine. It's expected and normal and correct and fine with this card. But the most vocal opponents of this have questioned that and what the longevity of the card might be at 110 degrees Celsius, which is what the hot spot of the card, the reference card, gets to if you game for an extended period of time. It's just
right.
AMD decided, and they told the press this, that they were going to favor noise over performance with their cooler. They went with a blower cooler, which is always going to be louder at higher RPMs. Just blower style coolers are, they have kind of a whine to them that get quite loud. They kept it under 50 decibels under full load. I think capping it around 48.5 decibels. So at a certain point, the temperatures just start to rise because the cooler will not spin any faster unless you're using a custom fan curve. So this is only an issue if you use an AMD reference design card. And there are a bunch of partners out there, including Sapphire, including XFX, and others who have these. Basically, they're putting their brand on the AMD reference design with the AMD reference cooler. This is a totally custom design. We looked recently at the Sapphire Pulse, which was the first custom card that I had my hands on in this new 5700 series. The thick from XFX is bigger. It's a lot bigger than that Pulse card was. It's still a dual fan design, but they're it's just physically very large. And there's so much more surface area for more heat pipes, more fins. This has 4 6-millimeter heat pipes in it. It has a zero RPM idle, like a lot of these newer graphics cards that come out. So under idle, temperature is going to be a little higher than you might be used to, because it's all about, you know, how warm is the air inside of your case? How warm is the air in your room? So I was seeing idle temperatures were like close to 50 degrees at times. It just depends on what's going on with your system. But once the fans actually kick on, they weren't that loud. They were, because I know that's a big focus of these aftermarket coolers. People have been waiting for these custom designs, not necessarily for higher performance, and I'll get to that in a second, but full load with the performance BIOS, because there's actually a BIOS switch on this, like a lot of these cards have, where you can choose a more aggressive fan profile where it ramps up faster, or a less aggressive one which favors silence. Based on the findings I had as far as temperature goes, I left it on performance mode. It's close to 44 dB under load. It's still about 4 or 5 decibels quieter than a reference card. And because it's these larger fans, it's not the same sound signature at all. If you can imagine the sound of just air moving across fins, that's what you're hearing instead of like the whine of a jet engine or a hairdryer, for example. So much less obtrusive noise. But this is also clock tire. This is not your typical stock card. If you use GPU-Z to look at the properties of your graphics card, you'll notice something interesting if you have an RX 5700 series card in your system, because AMD quotes GPU clocks in 3 different groups. They have their default, their game clock, and their boost clock. And this base clock is not actually what it will sit at on your desktop. It's the kind of the worst case scenario frequency if you're backing your card into a corner with something like FurMark. That's as high as it will go. So when we actually look at GPU-Z with these cards at desktop, it's quite a bit lower than that. I think the base is supposed to be 1400 megahertz. With the Pulse card we looked at before, it was 1419. With this card, it's actually 1442. Doesn't sound like a lot, but we're talking about a 42 megahertz overclock, which carries on through the boost frequency, which is it's about 84 megahertz above reference. Well, actually a little bit more than that, because they only quote 1905 is like the top clock speed of the 5700 XT. So it should have better performance, is what I'm saying. Better cooler. Right. More capable cooler, higher clocks, and it absolutely does. If you were to compare this card to that Pulse card that we previously looked at, we're talking, I think I said it was an average of about 3 to 5. The average when I told it all up was 3 frames per second. So don't get this because you're going to get unbelievable performance gains over a reference card. Get this because it's going to be about 5 dB quieter, and it had significantly better temps, although default BIOS, and I think they were trying to be a little bit less aggressive with the fan profile with this card. And this is something where they might be offering some alternate BIOS versions, and they have that BIOS switch. You can kind of go between quiet and performance, but default, it was at 74C under load. So pretty quiet, 90 or pretty low temperatures for this card, but 91C hotspot. That's still 19 degrees below AMD's reference and the claims they have of what the actual max temperature of this card are. I increased the fan speed, just as a fun test here, match the noise output of a reference card and see what the temps are like. And that ended up being about a 60% constant fan speed. I used MSI as afterburner to do that. And then same test, it went from 74 degrees to 67 degrees. The hotspot went from 91 to 84. And that was in a 24C room. So 500 RPMs of fans, if you can deal with a little bit higher noise, and that was, you know, it was noticeable. It was about 49 decibels. But you can get really, really good performance out of this card at about the same noise level, and you can get decent performance out of the card at a lower noise level. But it's kind of crazy to look at the power results with this review, because this is the most power-hungry card I've tested so far with this test bench, which now includes, really? I think, 14 different cards I've tested. Yeah, this more power than a Radeon 7. Radeon 7 with this test bench, which is an i7-9700, it's 32 gigs of memory, a Z390 board, 1,000-watt gold power supply. That system draws a total of 335 watts with a Radeon 7 during a gaming load from the wall. And a 2080 Ti Founders Edition is at 352 watts. This was 375 watts at the wall with the Thick 2. And so that, even that fairly mild factory overclock, significantly increases the power draw. It's just crazy. It continues to be evident that they didn't leave a whole lot of performance on the table with this GPU, because you start overclocking the 5700 XT, you're going to see huge increases in temperature and power. And I have no doubt that if they had gone with a totally stock approach to the clocks with this card, they'd have far, far lower temperatures with this giant cooler they're using. But they kind of equalized it. They said, well, we have this better cooler, we can bump up the clocks, we can give you better performance. And it's still a little bit quieter, it's still a little bit cooler, but I think you'll see some options out there that end up being quieter still and with better temps. So we'll just have to keep on looking. But not a bad option at all. And it's just another good alternative to the reference card out there in the market. Pricing was not high with this. I think it was $419. Yeah, $419 for this. There's going to be an ultra variant as well. It's going to be $439 that will have even higher clocks. But yeah, I mean, for $20, if you absolutely are opposed to a blower style design, you don't agree with AMD that 110 degrees is totally fine, then yes, this is a good option. Plus, you know, if you're anti-RGB, it's one of the few cards we're going to see without any kind of lighting, no light up logos, absolutely nothing. It's kind of your stealth option.
And a full on 50s chrome grill.
Exactly.
Well, 50s grill. HTC Vive Cosmos in Gadget got, Cole Lee over in Gadget got eyeballs on with it. It's their new $700 consumer VR headset. VR never looked so good. Also concludes a trial subscription to Vive Port Infinity, new RGB LCD panels, a combined 2880 by 1700 pixel resolution, which Nicole notes is an 88% increase over the original. That's a big deal. And still hitting like a 90 hertz refresh rate, also a big deal. 110 degree field of view. Quote, the result is the best VR display I've ever seen. Pre-orders are up now. It's going to be shipping October 3rd. If you scroll around, you will see the sort of flip-up mode on that, which I actually am a big fan of. If you've ever had to wrestle your face out of a VR headset because somebody came into the room with you, the idea of being able to flip the thing up and look at someone is huge. So, you know, they also have an integrated pass-through camera mode, which was not particularly effective in my interpretation of Nicole's experience. It was, well, she said it was so blurry I could make out people's faces. And then HTC's O'Brien said, quote, it's not very good at the moment. It's quite primitive now, yes. So, you know, not quite ready for prime time, I think, is an easy one to say on that one. Inside-out tracking, which I love.
and new 6 degrees of freedom controllers, which work with the inside out tracking. So very, very similar looking, by the way, Nicole notes, to the controllers on the Oculus Rift. So I'm down with that. The subscription is pretty cool. Viaport Infinity, that's the unlimited game service that HTC is putting together. That would normally be $13 a month or $100 a year. They're giving you a free year on that one, which is slick. Pre-orders now, and again, shipping on October 3rd. I'm excited about that. Very, very curious to see what the kind of titles that are available on the shipping on that. The other one I'm really excited about, did you see the Apple Arcade is going to be available September 19th at $4.99 a month?
Yeah, that's
crickets.
Surprisingly affordable for them.
Yeah, actually.
And Apple TV Plus is going to be $5 a month, right? So they're just going with this $5 model. Get as many people on board as possible, I guess.
That actually makes sense to me. Yeah, September 19th for Apple Arcade, $4.99 a month. 150 countries, big launch. That is a big, big launch. It's going to support Apple's family sharing feature. 1 month free trial at the launch. And something like 100 titles. So I'm kind of excited about this because a couple of the favorite games in our family, Monument Valley, Ustwo, is the studio that made that, Snowman, who made Alto's Adventure, which are two of my kids' favorite games. Final Fantasy creator Hironobu Sakaguchi, SimCity creator Will Wright, were all part of the crew that was touted back in March when this was first revealed. I don't even know how to react to some of this. Frogger in Toy Town from Konami was shown off at the Apple event. And, quote, an all-new title called Shinsekai Into the Depths from Capcom, Annapurna Interactive, Sayonara Wild Hearts. There's demos of these that you can find. Not demos. There's videos of these you can find if you get lucky. I think this is really interesting, right? And, of course, it follows Xbox's, or I should say Microsoft's Xbox Game Pass. Google is eventually going to launch Stadia. Ubisoft has their own standalone service right now. Then there's a crazy list, right? New entries in the Rayman series, new entries in the Pac-Man series. Apparently a new take on the iconic, and I quote, Choo Choo Rocket, which is a Dreamcast puzzle game, and was like the first Sega Online multiplayer game. Talk about going for your sort of middle-aged nostalgia. Props Nick Stat and Andrew Webster for getting like all of this put together. It's a crazy list, because if you look at this, right, the press release for this, Exit the Gungeon from Devolver. Players must escape a collapsing hell dungeon as increasingly perilous obstacles and opponents stand in their way. Pac-Man Party Royale with a four-player battle mode where the last Pac-Man standing wins. Projection First Light from Blowfish. Players follow the adventures of Greta, a girl living in a mythological shadow puppet world as she embarks on a journey of self-enlightenment, helped by legendary heroes from ancient cultures along the way. Rayman Mini from Ubisoft. Rayman is the size of an ant. Skate City from Snowman. Quote, brings the heart and soul of street skating to life with multi-touch controls. The city streets become the ultimate skater playground, which I can totally see my boys losing hours to. Lots and lots of stuff. So, you know, and lots of categories. I'm really kind of curious how these play. And, you know, between $5 a month and family sharing, this looks like kind of a no-brainer for a lot of people. Chips. We were talking about Chips, and Chips was looking... Chips felt it, he emailed back, felt it was a little insulting saying throw more processor at it. And I would also like to point out that this is the advice from Microsoft. And also one of the things we pointed out that is way too kind of granular and inside baseball to get into is there is a lot of optimizations you can make within spreadsheets to make them run faster. And that's kind of something you have to do on a case-by-case basis because we don't have the knowledge, nor have I seen a great summary of how to do these things to minimize the impact of your spreadsheets and how your calculations are done to maximize performance. But he did have one easy server fix he shared with us. He said, I plan on putting in an additional storage for the MS SQL Server to hold the temp index file. When I got the case open, I saw that it had been sound dampened with quite a nice layer of padding, including over the vent holes in the chassis side. I unscrewed the padding cover and kept the vent holes, put it back together, and restarted. Yep, the extra venting seemed to be just enough to bring the CPU speed level to a higher level. The Microsoft SQL Server box is now operating close to what was expected. Not so lucky with the MariaDB Linux boxes. No blocked vents with those. Still operating well below what we think they should be doing. So don't cover the ventilation on your server. That's solid advice.
But Patrick, servers are loud. And obviously the solution is to, you know, use heavy noise panels over every opening.
Over the vents.
Yeah.
It's your re-education will begin later. You know, yeah. Aesthetics.
What you want to do is put it underwater. I mean, the liquid-cooled rack server should be a thing. Although, I mean, it is a thing. But in this case,
if I never put another PC inside mineral oil again, I'll be a happier man for it. We also had a lot of people tweet. And by the way, you can tweet at Patrick Norton or at Sebastian Peak. If you have an email question, if you have a hardware question for us, you can email twitch@twit.tv, twich@twit.tv. We highly recommend you email us. We'll get your questions on there. A lot of people ask, like, what did you do? Patrick, your video's not washed out. And literally, we were talking about this in pre-show a couple weeks ago. Nothing. Same camera, same lens, same settings, same USB video capture device, same Skype, same operating system, same driver installation for the video USB video capture device. The only difference is I'm using a Lenovo laptop instead of an Intel-powered Lenovo laptop instead of a Ryzen 1800X desktop. So, you know, different motherboard and processor, considerably less powerful motherboard and processor. And the video saturation changes. So something that's going on with the Intel CPU or chipset's relationship to Skype is different than the AMD Ryzen's relationship to Skype. I'm gonna file this under Voodoo and see if anybody out there listening has some perspective on that one. So, but literally, same lighting. Same camera, same lens, same settings, same drivers, same operating system update, same Skype update, same adapter, different look on Skype.
Hey, Skype, it could just be friend. Like hardware encode related on the CPU side. So it's a thing. I mean, there could be a difference.
Well, it makes me wonder if there's difference in the way the Intel processors handle things versus the Intel versus the AMD. I don't know. It's, you know, a lot of millions of lines of codes in there and very difficult to figure out what exactly is going on. So I'm curious about that one. PCBird.com is the place to find more of Mr. Sebastian Peak. He's the editor-in-chief and the benchmarker at large. Is there anything you can tease that's coming up, or is it all super secret NDA?
Surprisingly, without revealing anything, I will say that for the middle of September-ish, it's quite a bit of stuff that I cannot comment on. I don't know if that in itself reveals anything, but yeah. I mean, there's things, but the stuff I'm personally working on, I can't talk about. I mean, if I were to be working on anything that I can't talk about, I wouldn't be able to talk about it. It's all theoretical.
Stuff is coming, but I won't tell you what it is because then attack lawyers will drop from the ceiling and remove me from my household. I will never see my child again. NDAs are scary, people. I don't know. I'm excited. I'm kind of curious to see what it is. I'm going to guess that it's a new partnership between NVIDIA and Intel with a superprocessor that's designed to make Windows cleaner.
Yeah, they're going to be harnessing the cloud and deep learning to enhance your Windows desktop experience. And Skype is going to become 100% GPU accelerated. And it's going to be 3D in VR.
I really wonder if it's something. I really wonder if it's something in the acceleration, in Skype.
Yeah, I was actually, as exciting as this is, I was looking at a Citrix support article about Skype for Business, and they were talking about all the different things that can affect Skype video quality. Of course, they have on the list the webcam. Like, oh, really? The webcam could affect the performance of the video? But they were talking about, you know, things like the ability of the CPU to accelerate H.264 in onboard hardware. So I'm thinking maybe there's just a difference with how AMD was approaching versus how Intel is approaching H.264 video encode. Is there any kind of quick sync going on with the Intel side with Skype? Was that a factor? Who knows? But for audio listeners, I will point out that imagine the black levels of Patrick's video now as being a dark room in the middle of the night with no lights on. So in other words, black. And then imagine his white levels previously as looking like a gallon of milk. So they were basically no black levels before. It's like turning up your LCD TV's brightness setting, which just raises the black levels.
It
was I was trying to be funny. But I mean, it looked like somebody just turned down the contrast and turned up the brightness on a TV.
Right.
And now it's all back to normal.
It's weird. And literally, there was nothing we could do in terms of camera settings that had any kind of meaningful change on it. So
I maintain user error. And I'm looking at you, Patrick. He did something.
Error between
he
keyboard and chair, ladies and gentlemen. It's all my fault. I own up to it. I completely altered the microcode inside of...
Stop doing that. That's not open source. Stop modifying the code. It's proprietary code, Patrick.
Windows. Like, I can modify the Windows code if I needed to. Oh, my goodness, ladies and gentlemen. This weirdness you've been listening to, this joyful exploration of hardware, this love of the desktop and the laptop and the mobile and the console, this is Twitch This Week in Computer Hardware. You can find it at twit.tv/Twitch. I'm Patrick Norton. You can find me at Patrick Norton on the Twitters. Sebastian Peek, you can find at PCPer or PCPer.com or at Sebastian Peek on the Twitters. If you haven't been to the website, go there. You'll get all of the older episodes and information on how to subscribe, or just search for This Week in Computer Hardware on your favorite podcatcher, and chances are you're going to find us there. And if not, tell us. Email twitch@twit.tv, and we'll do what we can to get it up and running on that system. We don't care if you watch it on video or on audio. We're just thankful you do. Please subscribe, tell your friends, and email your questions to twitch@twit.tv. And with that, ladies and gentlemen, I'm Patrick Norton.
And I'm Sebastian Peek.
We'll catch you next week on Twitch.